Hello, welcome again to South Beach Sessions. Happy New Year to everyone. You know, if you've been listening to us for a while, that we have a bit of an obsession with the owner of the Jacksonville Jags and his marvelous mustache. We're not talking to him this week, but we're talking to the result of a romantic moment 40 years ago or so that he had that birthed the man we are talking to, Tony Khan. He is the president of All Elite Wrestling. We like to talk to a bunch of different people around here about a bunch of different things. He took on a venture that a lot of people would have questioned whether or not it could be formidable given the stranglehold that Vince McMahon has had for many years over wrestling. And he doesn't do much of this. He doesn't do many interviews. So we got a chance to talk to him, and we are also trying to figure out a way to get onto his father's seven-story yacht. So we decided let's talk to him about All Elite Wrestling and his father and his upbringing, and because he's had an unusual path to get to some of the places that he wanted to get to, and he chose wrestling. Could have done anything, right? And he chose, I want to build a wrestling empire. So here he is, Tony Khan, after Mike Ryan quickly tells you about this week's sponsor.
Dan, it's made possible by our friends at ZipRecruiter. It's a new year, the perfect opportunity to take your business to the next level by hiring the right people. But finding qualified candidates can be challenging. ZipRecruiter.com/beach makes it easy. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find the people with the right experience and invite them to apply to your job. As those applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each and every one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/beach. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BEACH. ZipRecruiter.com/beach. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And if you're enjoying what you're listening to right now, South Beach Sessions, as you know, Dan, this is a part of the Levitard and Friends Network. We have plenty of great podcasts on this network, including Mystery Crate, which is a fun grab bag, mostly built around the shipping container characters. And we like to have a lot of fun. You never know what you're going to get every week, and this week will be no different. So please, if you like what you hear, please subscribe, rate, and review, and check out some of our other properties, including Spotity, The Mina Kimes Show with Lenny, but also Mystery Crate.
Tony, before we get into your upbringing and how it is that you were raised, can you take me through where your wrestling roots start? Like, how is it that you became obsessed and this kind of obsessed?
It's funny because the first time I ever saw wrestling, there weren't a lot of different channels. There weren't a lot of shows to watch. And one of the biggest shows was the A-Team. And I saw Hulk Hogan on the A-Team. And he was like a special guest star in that, like, he was almost like a guest member of the A-Team. Like, he rode in the van with them. Like, he would distract people when they were on the missions and stuff. And they showed him in the context of being like Hulk Hogan, the wrestler, and wrestling. And it's kind of crazy. That's the first time I ever saw wrestling, but that's the first time I really remember seeing anything with wrestling at all. And then I wanted to learn more about it. And then I started watching and learning about all the different wrestlers when I was like 6, 7 years old. It just became like a huge part of my life, like other sports, you know, around the same time that I was becoming obsessed with football and basketball. And I would go to the Illinois football and basketball games as a kid. I would also watch as much wrestling as I possibly could.
So you see Hulk Hogan on the A-Team and you're like, I need to find out more about what this thing is?
Yeah, kind of. Basically, yeah, that's it.
And so who were the wrestlers of your youth? Who were the obsessions? Was it like a world was opened up to you, a creative, imaginative world?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Dan. Ric Flair and Macho Man Randy Savage, Bret Hart were guys that I was a huge fan of as a kid, and they were some of my favorite athletes, and I didn't know the difference when I was like, you know, 6, 7 years old. You know, if you asked me who all my favorite athletes were at the time, I probably would have said, like, Jeff George was the quarterback of Illinois when I was a kid, and Randy Savage, the Macho Man. That was part of it, but also that I just really loved sports, and it seemed very peripheral to sports, and it was kind of the perfect marriage of all the TV I watched and all the sports I watched as a kid.
So where and how does this become something that you're taking to your father and your father saying, yes, I like this idea as a business? Like where, what had to happen between that, you know, the A team at 6 years old and now you're coming to him at what age saying something that's
36.
Pretty
30, appropriately enough, 30 years passed there. Yeah. So
right.
A lot of time passed. I grew up and began working in sports. And when my father bought the Jaguars, that was my first job in sports. And I worked for the Jaguars for 8 seasons. And after he invested in sports properties with the Jaguars and with Fulham, and I'd made investments in sports analytics. And I own and operate a company called True Media out of Boston, which ESPN works really closely with. We provide baseball, football, soccer analytics for all ESPN platforms, TV and online, and work really closely with the Stats and Info Group, and also work with 19 of the 30 Major League Baseball teams. So I had put together some interesting business cases before, but this was something very different. And to the point, you know, where he asked, like, where he thought this was like a good business case that he felt really good about, that didn't really happen until we launched, because it was a leap of faith on his part, because the projections I was giving him, there was no evidence that this was actually going to happen. I had to tell him, I expect people are going to buy these pay-per-views. I expect we're going to get this television deal. Right now is the perfect time to start a wrestling company because the abundance of talent that's available. As I explained it to him at the time, if you were going to go try and start an NFL team, well, A, you know, there's huge barriers to entry. Nobody's going to let you into the NFL. Okay, well, you could go start another football league, but to get fans, people are going to want to see the name players that they're familiar with and the best level of football. And the top quarterbacks, for example, to put together a great passing game are all in the NFL. We were in a really unique position in the world of wrestling where a lot of the best talent and most capable wrestlers were going to be out of contract at the beginning of 2019. And there was a chance to put together a roster of wrestlers that would make us one of the top leagues in the world.
So how long before your father came around? What were the initial conversations like?
The initial conversations were like, this is kind of interesting. He wasn't really going to commit to anything. And then I had brought in my good friend Kevin Riley, who also had shown some interest in the project. Kevin is the president of Warner Media and is the president of TNT and TBS Networks. And Kevin is the first person I'd really approached about this idea when the TV rights for wrestling had gotten very valuable. And his network was going to be looking at getting involved. They didn't end up bidding on the WWE TV contracts to the point where they were, you know, going to be seriously considered, I think, air Raw or SmackDown. But they had, you know, taken a look at that and done their due diligence. And I think he realized that there's a big audience for wrestling and that, you know, for live TV viewership, it's really a great way to bring new viewers to your channel. And TNT had a great history of broadcasting wrestling, going back to WCW and even before WCW to Jim Crockett Promotions and different wrestling companies out of Georgia. And so really, with Kevin coming in, my dad was, of course, interested because here's the president of Warner Media, the president of these huge cable channels, TNT and TBS, and he's showing some interest in this. So my dad's, I think, thinking, okay, well, I probably should show up and show some interest in this. But he knew that when that happened, okay, well, if the networks are taking a look at this, this must be a serious deal. But where things got kind of tricky, and it's funny because I was actually in Miami, of all places, last year around Christmas time, and we had no TV deal, and I had no commitment from TNT or any other network partners that they were actually going to do this. All I had was they were definitely interested. I had no commitments from anybody, really, and it was going to be a big leap of faith on his part that all this stuff was going to come together, that our pay-per-views were going to be successful, that all these wrestlers that I believed were going to sign with us in the new year, that they would sign with us in the new year. And he ended up believing me, and I was really thankful. But he's done interviews since where he said, you know, he's really glad he took that leap of faith because it's worked out so well, the company's grown. But he's been the first to admit he was really skeptical and honestly didn't believe it was going to work.
Were you bluffing or were you doubting or what was happening? How scared,
no.
How scared were you that you don't have these things down and secure?
I was worried, but I believed I could get them because I knew that there was interest. You know, I'd heard from other TV channels that they had had serious interest in it if this hadn't happened. I believed in the wrestling community. I believed in the wrestling fans, and I believed that this was something that everybody had been wanting for so long, for somebody that had the resources and the love of wrestling to step up and put together a roster, start a new league, and do something with the production values that are really going to make people sit up and take notice, because there hadn't been a second major company running a live weekly television show from a different, you know, nice arena every week. I think people have tried doing, you know, weekly TV shows, they've toured, and people have tried with much, much lower production values and much less of a production budget than we have for our show. And they tried doing them, you know, taping in theme parks and stuff like that. But it just doesn't really have the same look as when you tour the country and you can run a great basketball arena like we've done. And I think that's kind of part of the appeal of the show, is it's old and it's new. It's like the newest, most exciting, fast-paced, high-flying wrestlers of today. And it's new and it's old in that, like, our promos are almost like the Curb Your Enthusiasm of wrestling, because I really don't believe in sending a wrestler out there with, like, a 10-page soliloquy and a script to memorize. And I find that when I watch other wrestling shows, it's often, like, painful to watch people talk. And sometimes these are really charismatic guys that could hold, like, a really, really, really interesting conversation, but they're being, like, force-fed dialogue that no actual human being would ever say in a realistic conversational situation. But, and somehow these guys were supposed to believe them and believe in them. And when I was a kid, I never would have gotten behind somebody that was reading like that kind of a script. I really believed in the charismatic wrestlers of my childhood, that these guys, their personalities, they were the best talkers there are.
Is that part of what drew you, the idea of flamboyant charisma? Did you have a lot of that ethnically in your life?
I don't know, maybe. I don't think my household was that conservative. My parents are really, really cool people. And you've probably seen my dad talk and got a feeling for him that, like, especially in the world of, like, NFL owners, he's a pretty chill guy. So I don't think it was any kind of rebellion or anything like that. I just think I thought it was cool. And that these are larger-than-life athletes. And I've always loved sports. And, you know, when I was a kid, like, Deion Sanders was doing pizza commercials where, you know, he was getting the baseball pizza and the football pizza for each game. And, like, you know, there were big charismatic athletes then, but it seemed like the wrestlers had bigger personality as anybody. You know, there was Dennis Rodman, Deion Sanders, and the Macho Man were kind of the wild athletes when I was a kid. But, yeah, I wouldn't say it was anything in my house. Like, my parents were always, like,
it could have been really, a mustache. Really, really cool. It could have been the mustache. The mustache, I mean, that's all I need to know about your dad, isn't it? Like, your father must have a flair for flamboyance if he's wearing that fur under his nose.
That's fair. That's fair enough. But, you know, he's also, like, one of the most fun people you'll ever talk to. But he's also really a hard guy. And I had to work really hard in this business case. And even in the end, there was no concrete proof. As with most business cases, it's pretty hard to prove something's going to work until it actually goes out and works. I spent enough time with him, walking him through the projections, introducing him to Kevin. Even though, you know, Kevin had never committed, I'm definitely going to do this, he certainly knew Kevin was flesh and blood, real guy who'd met with us a few times and had interest. It was a leap of faith on his part, but for me, you know, it's always been very consistent with my parents to be, like, really supportive of me. They also wouldn't have just, like, poured money into a venture unless I'd worked, like, really hard to show them that I can make this work and made them believe that there had to be a chance that it could work.
Forgive the stereotyping here, but analytics world and wrestling world, those are two very different worlds.
You know what's messed up is how many of the top people in football analytics are obsessed with wrestling. Like, so there's actually a huge cross-section. Or do you ever
Belichick? Belichick's a huge wrestling guy.
Greg Roman is a huge wrestling fan. Greg Roman is an obsessive wrestling fan who used to write to the newsletters in like the 80s and 90s. So no, I don't know if Bill is a huge. I'm actually really, really close with Bill, but I've never asked him if he was a big wrestling fan. But now that you've asked that, I will have to ask him. But yeah, like Greg Roman, for example, is a huge, huge wrestling fan. I meet guys all the time in the NFL who are, but specifically in the analytics community. Like, do you know the Football Outsiders website?
Yes, uh-huh.
All those guys are into wrestling. And like Bill Barnwell, before Bill and I knew each other through the world of football, like Bill Barnwell and I would post on the same wrestling message boards when we were little kids. And then when we met in the world of football analytics many years later, it was like, wait, are you the same Bill Barnwell I talked to when I was a kid about wrestling?
How did your career veer off? Because you said, you know, 7-8 years doing this, you were in the Jacksonville, you know, learning the ropes of your father's business. Clearly you were headed on a different path than the one you ended up on, no?
I'm still doing that path. I used to spend a lot more. This is going to be a blatantly honest assessment of my life and where we're at with all of our different businesses. But to be honest with you, Dan, things got a lot better for me when I stopped spending every minute of every day beating my head against the wall about things I couldn't control. And I used to be in this office in Jacksonville every day, all the time, beating myself up about things here. And it's not in my control. Like, I'm not the head of football here. And so I've gone out and tried to do, like, other things in my life rather than just beating my head against the wall over the last several years. So I still am, like, the head of analytics here. But the head of analytics at a lot of NFL teams, like, that job involves a lot of beating your head against the wall. And so any time I had, I started to branch out and do other things. Several years ago, I took over as the general manager and sporting director of the English football club my dad owns, Fulham. And we've had ups and downs there, but certainly from when I took over, we're much, much better shape and have had some of the great days at the club since then. And in a much better place than we were when I took over as a director of football a couple years ago. But really, I've been here since 2012, and I've never been the head of football. And anybody who's obsessive with football analytics will tell you that most stuff in the NFL, like, there's so many things that do not jive with what the analytics guy's probably saying. And I think a lot of your nerdier listeners, a lot of my fellow Football Outsiders readers and people who are into the next-gen stats that the league puts up and sabermetrics people are probably all nodding along, and they know that that's not what I'm saying at all. And, you know, for all these years, because I've, have had that time where I can put together the stats for the game, put together reports for the coaches on the draft picks. You know, the time I really enjoy the most in the NFL for me, outside of the games themselves and the season, is the undrafted free agency. Because I'm not in charge of the draft picks. I can't make draft picks. But I generally have been able to sign undrafted free agents and have found some pretty good players using stats and analytics to identify good undrafted talent. That's one of my favorite things to do. But again, you know, these are things that I should have a little bit of time left in my life. And rather than, like, get a social life or get, like, a personal life or whatever, I chose to, like, go out and try and do some other things, like, and make some other businesses and build other things up. And I'm really glad I have, because, you know, if I was still beating my head against the wall, I probably wouldn't have gotten to where I got with AEW and probably wouldn't have had this great day we had at Fulham a couple years ago where we got promoted at Wembley Stadium.
What's your backstory, though? When you go back to your childhood, how would you explain to the people listening who don't know or have any idea how you grew up? What are the important details?
I mean, probably the most important thing, if you want to go back in a nutshell, is that I love sports statistics and I love wrestling. And when I was, like, I lost a lot of weight. Like, if you look at me now, you probably wouldn't picture me as I was when I was, like, 15. From, like, 15 to 16, and especially from 15 to 17, I really did, like, a major transformation. So I'm the same person inside, but outside, you know, I got braces, glasses, and lost about 50 pounds in the span of about a year and a half. So it was like a physical transformation in high school. But if you saw me, my natural habitat kind of before I went through this puberty spurt, that was it in a nutshell. Like, just watching tons of football and basketball and wrestling and obsessed with those things. We didn't have a football team where I went to high school, so there was no team to keep stats for. But our basketball team, I would be the stats keeper and sit on the bench with the coach. And each year I got more and more involved. And by the end, they stopped hiring a coach for the varsity. And I would just be like a sophomore in high school, junior in high school, and I would be the assistant coach of the varsity. And keeping the stats and looking for stuff that, you know, interesting breaks in the game. And this was before basketball analytics had really broken out. I mean, we knew, like, so much less about the game of basketball back then than people know about it now. But yeah, that would be me in a nutshell. I would, like, go to basketball practice after school, keep the stats, talk to the coach, and then go home and watch wrestling and procrastinate on my homework or anything else in my life, and that's pretty much it. I've always loved sports and wrestling, and I'm really fortunate to be able to work in it. And it's not exactly the same way. It's very, very different path that you took to be able to work with your dad. But I'm also really fortunate that I get to work with my dad and that he's been so open to bringing me into his businesses and giving me chances to do things.
But my dad wasn't worth $8 billion. Like, what was normal and not normal about your childhood?
To be honest, I think I had a pretty normal childhood. I grew up in a Midwestern town. The big change in my life, which was awesome for many reasons, is when my dad got involved with private aviation, probably around when I was 12, because at first it was great because I would see him more, because he used to, you know, go away on trips to Detroit or L.A. on business, and with, you know, commercial travel, he wouldn't be back for days. And then all of a sudden, the trips were a lot quicker when he started to take a private plane when I was a kid. And then we started to take some vacations on private planes and stuff. But until I was probably 12, 13, 14, I really didn't understand a lot of differences in my upbringing from anyone else I went to school with, to be honest with you. You know, my dad was not a billionaire when I was a kid. He was becoming a multimillionaire, and his business really grew through my childhood, and I watched it grow. But he definitely was not worth all those billions of dollars when I was a kid either. But, you know, certainly I also didn't want for anything, and he was like the hardest working, best dad anybody could ask for.
Did you want for a dad who was home more, or was he home enough? Did he have work-life balance?
Maybe before I was like 12, but then, like I said, when he got the private plane, I saw him so much more because, you know, if he was spent the day in Detroit, well, he would come home. You know, if he had to have a dinner in Detroit, well, he could still be home, and you'd also get an hour back on the flight. So he would, like, get home at the same time he left, basically. You know what I mean? All of a sudden, you start to see him a lot more. So, no, that was good. He was there as much as possibly could have been.
What makes him special as a businessman?
He's got really good instincts. He's a really hard guy to bullshit. I think in football, hopefully, now that he's learned more about football, I hope this serves him and us better, because certainly as he's learned about businesses, he's like a really smart person. He wasn't a football guy. He was not an X's and O's guy as he got into it. But I do think the longer he's in it, the more he's learned about it, and he's going to get better at that too. But certainly in the businesses he's grown up in and that he has like an encyclopedic knowledge of, specifically the automotive business, I mean, he's a legend in that industry. And what made him a legend in that industry, I think, is a combination of his instincts and the fact that he's somebody who keeps his word and he's got an integrity. And those are all things that have like really rubbed off on me. I think I'd like to believe that I'm a person who, you know, has good instincts and also has a lot of personal integrity. And, you know, for whatever this is worth, I people have told me in the different businesses that I'm in that I'm the most honest person in those businesses. In the world of English football and soccer in general, I've been told I'm the most honest man in English football. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I generally don't like BSing people. And I think a lot of times in teams and sports, trust is like a major issue. And when you have players or wrestlers or whatever your roster is, they trust you, I think that goes a long way.
What has landed on your doorstep that you weren't expecting in any way that came with this wrestling venture?
John Moxley. I never in a million years was expecting that John Moxley would be wrestling for us this year, and that he would have come in, especially so quickly in the year. He was on our first show. When we looked to launch AEW, I knew that there was going to be a good possibility. I've got another answer for you, too, that is non-AEW, but my AEW answer is John. And what happened was we launched at the beginning of the year. I knew we were going to launch with Chris Jericho, who's one of the biggest names in the history of wrestling. Chris is one of my all-time favorites. My dad, when I got into the University of Illinois Laboratory High School when I was 13 years old, he said, you can basically have whatever you want one time. What do you want? And literally what I asked him for was to take me to Philadelphia for a weekend to go to ECW.
Are you kidding me? Wait a minute. He offers you what was it? He's offering you a genie's wish. Why? Just because you're 13?
I got into the University of Illinois Laboratory High School, which is one of, if not the top academic high school, certainly in the Midwest, if not the United States. And my graduating class and the class before us, and probably the one after us too, I don't know because I was gone by then, but certainly pretty much every year we had the top ACT average in America per student. And my graduating class, so we had the number one ACT average in America for any class size more than 30 students.
And he offers you as a reward anything you want in the world, and you choose
within reason. He's like, well, what do you want? Like, you know, and I'll do something for you. What do you want? Like, and I really did not want to go to this school, and I got kind of tricked into taking the test. And then I took the test, and I got in, and I was told all I had to do was prove that you can do it. And then my mom pulled a little bit of a bait and switch in a McDonald's parking lot on me and started crying when I told her when I got the letter that said I was going to get in. And then I said, now I got in, but I don't want to leave all my friends. I want to stay, finish out my eighth grade year with, you know, all the friends I grew up with. And she said, well, you know, this is such a huge opportunity. And she started crying. And my dad said, well, you know, why don't you just do this? And look, like, you could have anything. If you could have anything, what would it be? And I said, I really wanted to go meet all my internet friends, which was kind of crazy because this was 1996. So, and I was 13 years old, and I had all these people that I traded tapes with to watch all the different wrestling from around the world, like Japanese wrestling of the 90s and Lucha Libre wrestling from Mexico in the 90s, and also a lot of older wrestling tapes from the 70s and 80s so that I could learn more about it. And it was going to be Chris Jericho's last weekend in ECW before he went to go work for WCW. And so I saw Chris's last two matches in ECW, which is funny because now Chris and I have talked about this a bunch, and my dad and Chris have talked about this a bunch. But my dad had no idea what he was walking into. Like, ECW in Philadelphia was like the demilitarized zone. And and he was so cool about it. That was, like, to me, one of the biggest things ever. So when you go back to, like, let me go back to your previous question, which was, sorry, I got off way off subject, and you asked me about what has fallen in my lap that I didn't expect. Well, Chris is one of my favorites of all time, and he's so many people's favorite wrestler. I think he'd be on a lot of people's Mount Rushmores and a lot of people's top fives, top tens. And whenever people ask me about AEW, they want to talk about Chris. But I knew when we did this, part of my business case was we could get Chris. Like, Chris and I had spent a lot of time together, and I knew that if I could make all the pieces fit, Chris would come. And we had all these exciting young wrestlers that were the fastest paced, most exciting guys, and they were building their own huge independent fan bases with the Young Bucks, Cody Rhodes, and Kenny Omega. What I never expected was that Jon Moxley would get out of WWE and be available to us from our very first show, because he's, you know, somebody who's huge in the world of wrestling that I'd never met, I'd never talked to when we started this, and that was a huge surprise to me. Another, by the way, thing that fell into my lap that is totally unrelated to AEW, but just to put my Fulham hat on for a second, to talk a little English football with you, is Alexander Mitrovic, who is a top, top, top player in not just in English football, but in the world of European football and soccer worldwide. Alexander Mitrovic is one of the best strikers, and the way we acquired him is actually a pretty crazy story, if you've never heard it.
I have not.
So it's, I know it's off subject, but the way Mitro came into our team, it was originally on a loan. He had originally agreed to go back to one of his former clubs, Anderlecht, in Belgium. And at the last minute, basically the transfer window in England is madness. And at the end of the night, if you haven't ended up somewhere, then you're stuck until the next window. And the only windows are the summer and the month of January. So on the last day of January, a couple years ago, Anderlecht, at the last minute, had this transfer fall through, and these guys had so much integrity, and he had so much integrity, and we had so much faith in this player that they ended up doing the medical for him there on site, because there was no time to fly him back to England. Like we were down to the final minutes, and they actually did his medical assessment at this other team that was like a total third party. You know, he's a star player at Fulham. He's a leading goal scorer right now in the English Football League. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the way that happened, because it's been one of the greatest things that ever happened to us.
You were basically guilted by your mother and bribed by your father into getting an education. I have that right?
Well, I would have gotten an education somewhere, but into getting the best possible education, that is correct, yeah.
And I can't imagine, even if it works out, though, or maybe they're just happy that their son is happy, but when you go from there in a family of achievers to wrestling, that is not the most common of paths. No matter how much you love it, I can see parents not loving that as a journey point.
You know what's crazy? They never did. They never supported it. They were fine about it. They weren't not supportive, but it wasn't like they encouraged it. You know what I mean? As being a fan my whole life. And as I've kind of moved on with my life and done other things in sports and with my life, you know, I don't think they thought of me as somebody that was sitting around watching wrestling. But when I had free time to myself these past few years, that's absolutely what I would do. Anytime I had a chance when I wasn't working for Fulham or the Jaguars or True Media, I would love to just sit down and watch wrestling and keep up on it. And as we launched AEW, my parents have never been prouder of anything that I've done. And they have been so awesome, and they've actually become wrestling fans. That's what it would take, you know, us getting involved in this business as a family and me getting involved in this day to day. They come to all the shows. Like, we're doing Dynamite in Dallas, and we're doing it in conjunction with the NFL owners meeting. You know the scene in Mrs. Doubtfire where, like, Robin Williams is going back and forth between, like, he's doing the job interview, and then he's, like, taking off in Mrs. Doubtfire.
You more than your dad, obviously, are going trafficking between the two worlds.
I am the one who's probably trafficking the most between the two worlds because I'm day-to-day. Like, I'm the president and CEO of AEW, but I also have NFL responsibilities. I'm on committees in the NFL. The NFL has got the league meetings and the owners meetings in Dallas, and I knew about this months in advance. Dallas is a top wrestling market. So when I was looking at scheduling shows, what do you think I thought would be a great week to run Dallas? if you could, like, I was describing the scene in Mrs. Doubtfire where he's, like, running back and forth between the two tables, that's going to be me in Dallas. I'm going to be bouncing back and forth between the league meetings and the arena where we'll be setting up and producing the show. And, you know, in the mornings I'll be with the NFL, and then in the evenings I'll be with AEW. It's pretty good microcosm for what life is like now.
Is it because you love both? Like, is it, what is it? You don't have to choose one, because either one of those jobs seems like it's plenty.
I love it. I love the stuff I'm doing. And I'd also be remiss not to talk about how much I love working at Fulham. Like, the greatest day I've ever had was the day Fulham went to the Premier League in May of 2018 at Wembley Stadium. And we're in third place out of 24 teams right now. And at the end of the year, the top three teams go back up to the Premier League, and I think we have a really good chance. And while I'm at, you know, this NFL league meeting and then going over for the AEW production meeting in Dallas, I'm going to be really closely watching our Fulham game against Preston. That's just what life is like now. I'm really very fortunate to do all these different things I love.
Mike Ryan wants to light you up. He's wearing his Chelsea hat right now. He's wearing all Chelsea colors. He wants to yell at you.
I mean, I really don't want to.
Why? I have a great relationship with Chelsea. Mike will tell you that they loaned us players when we got promoted. They loaned us Callis and Piazon, who were awesome. And I just bought Michael Hector from Chelsea, who's coming in January. So there are good friends at Chelsea.
Crosstown, it's a London derby. Chelsea Stadium is actually located in Fulham, and Craven Cottage is a delight. However, that being said, there's a reason why they weren't around in the Premier League very long. I'm just supposed to say this about arrivals. They really don't bother me all that much. It's a lovely place, and they've always had Americans.
Yeah, I don't know if there's another club in England that has had multiple players from America win player of the season, but I know there's nobody that's had three players from America win player of the season.
But we all know where the best American is, don't we, Tony?
Okay. Yeah.
Up the Chelsea.
He's very good. We've got Tim Ream and Luca Della Torre and Marlon Fossey. So we've got great American talent now, and we've had Brian McBride and Clint Dempsey. So I think Fulham has definitely had the best American talent of any club in the world, frankly.
What is happening with your parents when you say they're prouder of you with everything that you're opening on AEW than they've ever been? Like, what is it, because they realize that some of your childhood dreams have come true and they kind of doubted it, they didn't really support it, and here's their son, and their son was right?
No, they've been really great and supportive of things, but it's like, well, what had I ever done that was so great? You know what I mean? Like, I'm always happy to contribute to helping out here when things did go well a couple of years ago at the Jaguars, and they haven't always gone well. But, you know, I do my part here. And then at Fulham, we had a great season 2 years ago and went up, and I really worked my ass off to help us get up. And I was really disappointed when we didn't stay up, but I worked really hard to try and keep us up. And now I'm working really hard to get us back up, and I think they know and appreciate that. But AEW is something that, you know, they were there when it launched. They know how personal it is to us, and it's a family business, and they know how much of my heart and soul I put into this and how much I care about it. And they go to the shows, and that's so meaningful to me because I couldn't get my mom to watch wrestling for 2 minutes my whole life. And as a kid, like, I'd be watching it, and I, you know, I loved spending time with my parents. So it was like, but I wanted to watch wrestling. So, you know, I'd be in a room and Nitro would be on, and it'd be like, hey, you want to watch WCW Monday Nitro with me? And the answer would always be no, absolutely not. Now they can't get enough of AEW. They watch it all the time. I go home, they have it on the DVR. They come to the shows, and then they go home and they watch the show they were at. My mom doesn't, it's not like she just knows the top stars. It's not like she just knows, you know, Chris Jericho, John Moxley, the Young Bucks, Cody, Kenny Omega. She's like into everybody, all of our women's wrestlers, everybody, even the smallest acts on the show. It's really, really fun. Like when my mom is now really into like Luchasaurus and Marco Stunt and Jungle Boy, who are an upcoming act, when she meets the wrestlers, she's like the most bubbly, sweetest person. And I just had the best time with it because I never in a million years would have imagined my mom would be having such a fun time with wrestling.
Is your analytics department the reason that you guys stayed so long with Bortles when you shouldn't have?
To be honest, I don't make any of the big decisions. The only players that I've really brought in are undrafted free agents. Like Jared Wilson, who's our starting free safety, is a player I got out of the University of Michigan who, you know, nobody had a lot of interest in him. And he had played over 95% of the snaps on Harbaugh's defense. And they've been, any way you want to slice it, a top three, top five defense in America. And he's playing almost every snap. And playing in different positions, he would cover the slot, he would, you know, play in the box, he would line up in the deep third, and just a really nice player. And I was surprised when he didn't get drafted. Trey Herndon, who's been starting at corner for us, he was out of Vanderbilt. Scouts were not really talking about him, and we didn't have any good scouting reports on him, but he had some really good analytics and got him here, and the coaching staff really liked him after I had signed him, and it was a very cheap signing, frankly, to get an undrafted free agent that was not really in demand. But finding players like that, Mike Hilton was a player I signed who's gone on to be a very productive player for Pittsburgh who got cut from here after I signed him. In general, you know, I've signed a lot of defensive backs that have gone on to do pretty well and some other players. Corey Grant was a running back that did some good things for us. Had a really good first half in the AFC Championship game a couple years ago.
That one still haunts you, right? Yeah. That one still, that game, everything about that game where you had that game won in Foxborough, that one's got to still haunt you.
Yeah, I think about that play all the time in that game. And to be honest, I sent Bill a text, I think at like 1 a.m., just congratulating him, trying to be the bigger person. I think we probably had as good of a case to complain as the Saints did last year and make a big deal of it. And because I don't think that was necessarily the right call at the end of that game either, but we didn't, and we took it in stride, and maybe that wasn't the right choice. Maybe we should have spent the whole offseason yelling about it, but we didn't. And I don't know if everybody remembers that play happened in the game the way it did, but I can't really put it all on that one play either. I think had that call not been missed, where Miles Jack was not down and then he was running it back and they blew the play dead, I think it's very likely we would have won. We would have been up 16 points, and we would have kicked the extra point to go up probably 17 late in the game, and I don't think they would have come back to win, and I think we probably would have gone to the Super Bowl if they'd called it right. But at the same time, I think we probably could have done a lot more, and they scored the points in the second half, and we didn't on offense. And that's why that night, it was probably 1 or 1:30 in the morning, I ended up texting Bill, you know, congratulations. Like, you guys did it. You guys scored the points. I got to live with it, and I'm happy that it was you that won, and if it couldn't be us, and all the best. And then we kind of moved on from it since then, to be honest.
How does your dad process Jalen Ramsey arriving at camp in a Brinks truck? Like, does the wrestling fan in him enjoy that, or how does that work?
Well, he's not the wrestling fan. The wrestling fan in me really did enjoy that. But, yeah, I don't know if he enjoyed it as much as I did, but I thought that was pretty funny.
Can you tell me whether you believe our listeners play a looks-like game and your father gets some entries here, and I've got just a couple for you. You tell me whether you think that your father looks like this. Does your father look like a vaudevillian silent film movie star?
Yes.
Okay. Does he look like the villain who has tigers and lions roaming free in his home?
Yes.
Okay. Very good. So he does. So your father, neither one of those things is true, right? Your father, well, I know he wasn't a vaudevillian silent film movie star, but he wouldn't also be someone who would have exotic animals around the house, would he?
Oh, no, we don't have any exotic, just a French bulldog. He's got a French bulldog that he loves, and that's it. Two French bulldogs.
In what ways, though, are you a billionaire family? Like, what sort of us? If you had to show off something in your home, or in his home, that would show off, look, this is how it is that the family is worth $8 billion. What would you point to? Because it's got to be something bigger than private flying.
Well, I'm in my office at the stadium, and he's docked like a mile from here in one of the nicest yachts in the world. And he's living on it, right? So I would say that that's...
All right, tell me more about that yacht.
Exhibit A.
I want to hear more about that yacht. Take me on a little tour of that yacht.
Why don't I just take you literally on a tour of it? Are you in Miami in January?
Oh, the Super Bowl. We're going to get invited. Yeah, I would like to be hang out on the yacht in January and during the Super Bowl.
Well, I will hang out with you in January in the yacht. Are you, if you're around January 15th at the University of Miami on campus, actually, is it the Watsco Center? We'll be there on January 15th for AEW Dynamite. And so I'll be there then. And then there's the NAPTE convention. So we're actually doing a special episode called Bash at the Beach, AEW Dynamite, on January 15th. So I will definitely be there in Miami, and the yacht will be there. So I can give you a tour in person rather than boring your listeners.
Well, I don't think they'd be bored by it. I was hoping that you might show that it's got a helipad, right? Does it have a submarine as well?
Like, no, I've never been in a helicopter in my life.
That's real suffering.
I find them, they really freak me out, man. Single engine, single point of failure. It just really makes me nervous.
Who was the guy, Mike? Who was the yacht owner that the yacht was so big?
Roman Abramovich, owner of Chelsea, coincidentally, with the whale foreskin seats.
Yeah, but not only that, but he built a yacht so big that they can't dock it anywhere. It's not dockable anywhere.
Right. It has, I think it's like auxiliary boat is like one of the biggest boats in the world. Submarine.
So is it like that? Is the yacht like that?
Oh, no. It's very big, but it's not. I mean, it's dockable, and it's not. There's many places where it is not dockable, but it's dockable probably more places than what you just described. I think it defies description by words. I mean, they say a picture is worth 1,000 words. It's absolutely beautiful. It's massive. It's longer than a football field. You know, it's over 100 yards long, and 7 stories and. Each room's more beautiful than the next. My parents did an amazing job decorating it. They have great taste. The yacht itself, I really can't give it a good description that would, I think, like I said, probably looking it up online or I'll give you a tour in person.
But those things are money pits. Those things are money pits. The idea that...
No, my father, this is the genius businessman he is. He charters the boat for like $1.5 million a week, and people charter it all the time. So he's even got, this lifestyle paying for itself. That's how smart he is.
A million and a half a week for just people to treat it like a party boat.
I think that, the crew do a pretty good job making sure that the charter guests don't tear the place to pieces. And don't quote me on $1.5 million is the exact figure, but yeah, ballpark $1.5 million.
So what other examples would you give me of your father being a great businessman? Like what would you say to me is something you learned either a long time ago or recently where you're like, this is how my father does it that's unique?
I mean, he bought the Jaguars for like $760 million, I think, 770.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it was, that's a great buy. That's a great purchase.
He got in at the right time, right? He got in... the Carolina Panthers just went for much more than that very recently.
Yeah, and I think I do think we'll never see an NFL team sell for under a few billion ever again. And to get one for under $800 million, I think is a very astute business. And
how did he do that? How did you guys do that?
Well, if you recall, he had come kind of about as close as anybody could come to buying the Rams. Because Mr. Kroenke at the time actually was the 40% owner and Mr. Rosenblum was the 60% owner. And my dad agreed to a deal with Mr. Rosenblum to buy the 60% in 2010. And that's actually when Stan, Mr. Kroenke, used his matching right and ended up, that's when he became the 100% owner of the Rams. And then from there, the word was obviously out that, you know, my dad's looking to buy a team. He began working with Wayne Weaver, and about a year and a half later, they ended up closing that deal.
Tony, appreciate talking to you. Thank you for spending the time with us. I was just I did all of this just so that I could get a Super Bowl yacht invitation. So I feel like this
you
is,
got it.
This is a big success for me. Thank you for being on with us. We appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. I've always wanted to talk to you in any form or fashion, and to do it on your show is especially exciting.
No, preferable on a 7-story yacht. Preferable there.
We'll do the we can do the follow up there.
Yeah.